Welcome to the Fanboys Strike Back Weekly Review Podcast, episode 49.
I smile, you laugh, I look away. I sigh, you ask me why. I say it's okay and I'm just feeling down. Your hand on mine, I hear the words. If only love had found us first, alas, they would.
Hey, you're listening to the Fanboys Strike Back Weekly Review Podcast. I'm David.
I'm Eric.
And we are the Fanboys of Strike Back. Every week we go and we read the comics that came out. We read a lot of them. One of us will pick what we thought was the best book of the week. We'll go to our site, fanboysstrikeback.com, write a little review of that. And then we come here and we talk about those books, the good ones, the bad ones, the best one, everything. We're going to go in-depth on these reviews, so if you don't want to be spoiled, you might want to pause the podcast and come back later after you've read this week's books. But going into that, Eric, you had this pick this week, and what'd you pick?
I picked Titans number 5, and this one surprised even me.
This one has been kind of hit or miss.
What I've been saying about the story so far, Judd Winnick's been writing it, and what I've been saying so far is... the story's not bad, because I really like the story and I like the villain Trigon, because he's a classic Titans villain. And I and anyone who listens to this show knows I love this cast of characters, right. And they're some of my favorites. The really weak part about this book has been its inconsistent art, and it's been very cheesecakey, and just with the second artist, it was just downright bad. With this book, we get Julian Lopez, and he's going to be on it for, I think, only 2 or 3 issues, unfortunately. I looked it up. And it's still a little cheesecakey, but the character models are much better. Mm-hmm. It's just there's a lot more expression in people's faces. And it really elevated the level of this book. And what this issue basically was the big fight between... What we found out so far is that Trigon, who's the demonic father of Raven, has sired other children in the world, and so Raven has these demonic brothers who are trying to come. And Raven's always kind of fought the evil side within her, and she's like always tried to contain that. And now she has 3 brothers who are trying to find her and bring that out in her again and make her evil again. And so the big fight happened last time, and the plot was foiled by the Titans, and they decided to stay together. What this issue was it was the downtime issue. And so what we had was a really nice conversation between Beast Boy and Raven as far as, like, the ability to control their powers and how, over the years and the different cases they've had, their powers have changed a little bit, and it's been harder to control them. And really the internal struggle that Raven has had. And it's a family issue, you know. She's being drawn back to family, and it's kind of, you know, when you talk to people or if you're in one, a dysfunctional family, it's like, even though you recognize it's dysfunctional, even though you might know it's unhealthy for you, there's a lot of the time with people I've found who come from those situations, it's still, in even a relationship, an unhealthy relationship, there's still something to be drawn back to in that.
It's your family. I mean...
Yeah. And she still feels that, and this was very much an exploration of that issue for her. And so I thought that was really good. I like what was done there. And then the other two scenes, one was Cyborg finally getting fixed. He's got new legs, when he came out and he debuted for Flash and Donna and Roy, and all I could think of was Forrest Gump, you know, new legs. Which was awful, but they made the joke. It's like, you know, maybe these ones won't, you know, will stay on for more than, you know, 2 books or something like that. But the scene that really clinched this book for me was a moment between Nightwing and Starfire, who ever since they've been on the Titans, I'm always a fan of Nightwing and Barbara Gordon, mm-hmm. but I do like him and Starfire together. I just, you know, it never quite works out. And, like, one, you know, back in the day, they almost got married, and they just have a really long history. And it seems like whenever they get together, but they both kind of know it's nothing serious. It's like, yeah, we love each other in the way that, like, we'll always love each other, but it's never going to go farther than this. Right. And so they, and of course, this scene takes place in a pool because there. I swear, there's like an editorial note that says like, this book has to be like, you know, show as much sexy as you can.
Well, it seems like that's always the case whenever Starfire's around in any book.
That's true. I mean, that's very true. But I wonder how much of it is, you know, if maybe it's like legging sales. It's like show a little skin. But that's the only reason I can really think of. But besides that, there was this really good scene. And, of course, you know, Dick and Corey are in the pool. And, of course, you know, they're you know, checking each other out. And the sparks are flying again. And they almost kiss. And then there's this moment when Starfire says, like, we shouldn't do this. And she's and Dick's like, well, what? You know, you just used to, you know, when she's around, that's what happens.
Right.
But, you know, she starts talking about how when they got together, they were only 18 or 19 years old when they got together into a fairly serious relationship. And it's always hot, you know, back and forth, you know, together and not together for so many years. And she basically just kind of confronts him and says, you know, do you love me? And he's like, well, you know, I love you. And she's like, you know, not how I said before, like, you know, you're very important to me. I'll always love you type of way, but do you honestly, truly love me? And, like, there's just this scene of, like, him, he's quiet for a second, and then just a really, like, hushed no. And I was just like, oh, man, that's a rough scene right there. And she kisses him, and then she gets out of the pool and walks away, and, like, his first thought is, like, he asks her, he's like, you're staying with the team. And she's like, yeah, this is my family, and I'll stay, but that's that. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, that's a nice little coda for the end of their thing, whatever it is. I'm glad someone finally put a bookmark on it, at least, or at least brought it into the light and finally gave it some definition. But yeah, I mean, just that scene where, you know, she's asking him, you know, do you love me? And he's just, you know, no. I was like, oh, man, that's rough. Even for Dick Grayson, but...
Yeah, it was a very real scene. Like, that looks like something that anyone can go through, anyone can relate. There's a lot of stuff in this book that people could relate to, like the stuff that you said with Raven and now this.
Yeah. So, I don't know, it was just like, I've been so kind of, I don't know, I felt the book was waning a little bit, and I was really happy that this issue came out and kind of revived some excitement for me in this book. It was very much like a comeback kid book, so I had to pick that. It was pretty good.
Fair enough, yeah. The art was really good. I thought, I don't know who did the cover, but I liked the art in the cover, too.
Yeah, Delgado? I don't know. Yeah, the cover was really good, too.
And I just wonder why this book has always been so late, too. I wonder what's going on. I'm not sure if that's because they keep on changing artists or what.
I imagine. I just don't know why they can't keep a you know, a constant artist on that book. I think that's what's hurting it a lot, is it's just, you know, this is the third one in five issues, so.
Yeah. True. Let's talk about Action Comics number 869.
The goodness just keeps on rolling.
First of all, I want to talk about the cover. I love this cover. This cover just kind of represents Superman, because it's just him, Pa Kent, they're drinking soda pop, and it's just, like, very obvious that that's a bottle of soda pop, and I'm just like, that's... Because, you know, we were talking about Superman and what he should be, and Warner Brothers talking about making Superman dark. Like, this is exactly what Superman should be.
Yeah, he's a family, like... You know, hanging out with his folks and his wife, and, you know, he's just a good old boy.
Yeah, exactly. I was just really happy when I saw this cover. But, Jeff Johns, I don't know what is going on with this guy. If he just sits in his office or whatever and just writes 24 hours a day, but he has a grip on these characters, that is amazing.
Yeah, Even opening up the issue, like, the exact emotion that I left off with the last issue, of that really fear of Brainiac showing up in Metropolis and his little scouts coming out.
Yep.
And I think a lot of that is just portrayed through Kara. Like, you know, you this is the first Brainiac concept you're being introduced to of the new Brainiac, and she's selling it so well that, you know, just, oh my God, no. And through her fear, I'm afraid.
Yeah, she is, like, she's literally just, like, scared out of her mind, and you're like, well, what? I mean, if it's going to make Kara this frightened, you know, it's got to be really bad.
Yeah.
That's a very good point.
I got to say, the creepiness factor of those little, like, tentacles that shoot out of the scout's hands and into people's brains.
Yeah.
That creeps me out so much. But, it's just a great book, and I love the new Brainiac, that big muscled Brainiac, and he's talking to Kal-El in his ship, and just the kind of lengths that Superman is having to go through, and he's like, you know, I don't like inflicting pain on others, which doesn't seem to bother you and bothers me. He's like, usually, and then he just knocks the tar out of Brainiac. I love that.
I love the whole scene where he's basically useless. Like, Brainiac's just kind of holding him, and he's not exerting any strength at all. And so Clark actually has to take one of these tentacles, and he bites it. And it's like, it's nice to see Superman in that kind of desperation mode.
He's almost fighting dirty a little bit. I think what this scene really illustrates is, you know, like we were talking about making Superman dark. You don't have to make Superman, quote-unquote, you know, dark to have him be emotional or angry or something like that. It's just, you know, you can still have him be the farm boy, and then in certain aspects, when he's pushed too far, you know, it very much like in the Justice League cartoon, it's like, if he's pushed too far with an enemy who he knows can take it, he's going to unleash the fury.
Yeah, that's true.
So I really like that. And then
we got a big retcon in this issue, too. We find out that Kara's father, Zor-El, is alive, and he's in Kandor.
Do you think that's really them?
I think it seems like it is. I mean,
it does.
At first, it was a very good plot device, because they start talking about how it's Zor-El, and you're like, that's not Zor-El, this is way too convenient, you know, this is Brainiac doing something.
Mm-hmm.
But at the very end, nothing ever happens, so it seems like it's Zor-El, but, I mean, I don't know. I guess we'll just have to, you know, keep reading and find out.
Yeah, and at the end, you know, Metropolis becomes the new bottled city, I'm just so excited about this book. And then at the end, when we see the red thing flashing towards the sun, it's like, you know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that they have tied Brainiac into the, not only the death of Krypton, but that really they've tied Brainiac into the birth of Superman.
Yes, that's true.
And to do that, that's incredible. I mean, we always talk about Johns, how he can take the original concepts and go back to the well on them and improve on them. But to tie in back something like clear back into his origin, which is so firmly established, it's like, you know, it's great. I love that because it also raises the stakes for Superman, too.
Yeah, just like when we did our top five villains, and Brainiac was on my list, and I love me some Brainiac. He's just so smart and, like, calculated and cold. It's just so fun to read.
Yeah. A book that was very close to being the book of the week for me was Robin 178. And
still
this is
the spoiler stuff, or is this RIP related?
Smartly enough, it's still RIP related, but smartly enough, they dropped the banner from the top of the book. All right. What it's basically coming down, it's Search for a Hero Part 2, continuation from the last story, which saw Robin and Jason Todd arguing over what was the best way to handle
it. That's right. Wasn't there a new Red Robin at the end of that one?
Exactly. Right. And Jason was like, what the hell? That's my costume, you know? And basically, Tim is at a loss because Batman's disappeared and the gangs of Gotham are basically tearing each other apart. Jason's idea was to unite the gangs into a single army and then take out Crooked Cops and you know, control through chaos. Tim didn't agree to that philosophy, and so he stopped Jason from accomplishing that, but it's made very much aware in this book that Tim may be in over his head, and Tim might be being a little naive in that sense. And Jason even told him, he's like, what kind of world do you live in? And in this one, another ally who shows up kind of says the same thing. It's like, you're being very naive about this whole situation. You can't control this. And a lot of this issue is focused on Tim's reasoning that, you know, he might be in over his head. Like, he's trying to hold the city together pretty much by himself. Nightwing's gone dealing with Two-Face, which they do talk about in this, but trying to deal with, like, Crooked Cops and everything like that. Everything else that's going on, too, when he's not getting much help from the police department. It's just really interesting. Like, Tim's going really dark in this book, and, like, he's interrogating one suspect, and he's like, I should have broken his bone or something like that, you know, and it's like, that's not Tim Drake. He's turning into Batman, which is, I'm watching him fall like this, and I care about him, and that's never been his goal, and so I kind of, I'm, It's a fictional character, I totally realize, but I'm also, like, worried for him that he's just going too far. He's going over the edge.
You know what I just realized the other day? I was reading Infinite Crisis, and which is, I love that, that's a great story. I think we're gonna, I'm gonna post a little something on the forum about reading it again. But Tim Drake has lost, within, there's no timeline, but within the last couple of years, whatever, in the DCU timeline, he's lost his father, his girlfriend for a while, Connor and Bart, which are two of his best friends.
Yeah.
Like, his life is not good.
No, I mean, he's, like, I don't know how much they can really heap, more they can heap on him like that, like, before he just gets to the breaking point. And it's kind of brought up in this book, like, by the end of it, he's running scenarios on the computer in the Batcave as far as, like, what the gangs are going to do, and he thinks it's all going to come to a head at a certain point, which they talk about. But what was really interesting is Alfred comes by, and he offers him this idea. He's like, you know, and Tim's telling him, he's like, I just don't have any other options. And he's like, actually, you have a lot of options. Have you ever thought about retiring? And he tells Alfred, sure, but we get the internal monologue. He's like, no, I can never retire. And that was even from, you know, maybe 10 years ago in the Robin books, that was not his goal. He was always going to be Robin and then retire when he was done with it. He wasn't going to grow up and be a superhero. So it was really interesting to see that play out. And I'm what this book is, it's got great action. And there was another little thing by Red Robin, who seems to be watching over Tim. I'm going to get to who I think it is in a second, but it's just for me, because I'm so invested in Tim Drake's character. I've been reading him since he came out, and it's almost a downward spiral for him, and I'm really concerned about his character. And I don't know if they're doing this to build him up to be the next Batman or something, but it's a very interesting character progression, and it's happening so quickly. Because, like you said, he's been put through so much, but it seems like within the last several issues of his book is really where, like, they're squeezing the last bit of toothpaste out of the bottle, and, like, there's just not much more that he's going to be able to take without breaking.
Yeah.
And so, and then the fun part, speculation. So we have this Red Robin character running around. We know it's not Jason Todd. Back in 52... you'll remember that Rip Hunter had a blackboard that had all these little hints on it and things that happened throughout 52 later. Now, we've been privy to see that blackboard twice again through the Booster Gold book. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that has appeared twice on it is Jean Paul Valley lives.
No, you don't think so. No!
Where else is he going to show up? Where
he's going to be the new Batman. They're going to go back to it.
They wouldn't bring back Jean Paul, but I could very much see him being incorporated back in the Bat family if he's going to come back. Yeah. But I read that, and I was like, oh my god, Ezreal?
Ezreal, huh? They're kind of tarnishing the whole Red Robin costume thing, though. Like, that was such a cool thing in Kingdom Come, and now it's just like, anyone can be Red Robin.
Exactly. It's like we've seen it so much now. It's like I'm kind of done with it, but I am curious at the same time as who the hell is that? But,
wow. That'll be interesting.
Yeah, I don't know how they play it out. And
I don't know.
Really, right now it makes no sense of who would be in that costume, so.
Yeah, I mean, what about would it be Spoiler? Would it be his girlfriend?
No, Spoiler is running around as Spoiler. And so it's definitely a guy. I mean, it's a big guy. It definitely fits the build of Jean Paul.
Yeah.
So that's the only guess I really have right now. Hmm. But I've seen that twice in Booster Gold, and I'm like, ooh, it's likely going to happen. So
that's interesting. Let's talk about some X books. First off, I want to talk about Young X-Men number 6 really quick. This has definitely been the worst of the Messiah Complex reboots, which is just so sad because New X-Men Academy was such a great book. The first 5 issues of this arc, this whole reboot thing, dealt with the fact that Scott Summers got these ragtag groups of young mutants together. and he made them the new X-Men. Only you find out it wasn't really Scott Summers, it was actually Donald Pierce, who's part of the Hellfire Club. It was him in disguise as Scott. This was kind of like one of the worst-kept secrets. Found out about this a long time ago, so like reading the whole first five issues was just like, this is horrible. The art was just terrible. Some of the worst art I've ever seen. It was the same guy who did Kirkman's run of Uncanny X-Men, or Ultimate X-Men. It was just horrible. So this is the first issue past that storyline. This issue actually wasn't horrible, but still wasn't great. The only thing I wanted to really talk about this issue is that in the last story, a kid named Gray Malkin showed up. And Gray Malkin has a lot of power in the X-Men universe. Gray Malkin is like where the school is. That's the name of the... It's on Gray Malkin Lane. Cable Space Station was named Gray Malkin. All that stuff. So if you're going to introduce a character named Gray Malkin, that's kind of a big deal.
Right.
And they're kind of doing this... Hank's doing all these tests on him. And... Hank apparently finds out that this kid is an ancestor of Charles Xavier. And Scott's what? Like, well, what are you talking about? This kid's like 17 years old. And Hank's like, well, no, you know, going by his blood and blah, 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 he has to be at least 200 years old. So I don't know. That's the one thing I wanted to mention is that there's this new kid. His name's Gray Malkin. He looks old. He looks kind of... He's bald. His skin is gray and kind of decrepit. And they're saying he's the ancestor of Charles Xavier. I don't know how I feel about it. I'm not a huge fan. But it could be interesting.
It seems like... I don't know if this is just a Marvel trick. Well, no, I'm not going to call it a Marvel trick. It's a comic trick because they did the same thing in Batman.
Yeah.
But at least in Batman and Son... We've always known that there was a baby out there somewhere. We just thought it was never going to show up again.
Right.
Which I imagine a lot of parents have gone through. Well, poor parents might have gone through before. But they did this with Spider-Man too, with Gwen Stacy. As far as
the twins.
There's just kids that show up out of nowhere. And it's like, oh, well, yeah, of course Gwen Stacy and Norman Osborn had babies. And, right. It's the surprise kid. The showing up at your door and being like, you know, hi, you know, that kind of thing. And I don't know why, it's almost an overused trick, I think.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely a different take on it, because they're saying this kid is actually an ancestor, not a child. But it's still kind of... I don't know. There's always, there's always something nice and vibrant and exciting about a young X-Men book. When the New Mutants came out, it was great. When Generation X came out, it was great. When New X-Men Academy came out, it was great. Young X-Men, not good. You know? And it's just very disappointing, especially because, like I said, like, New X-Men was such a good book, and we've lost most of those characters. Most of those characters we haven't seen since Messiah Complex, which is kind of a travesty, because that was just such a well-written book. But, I don't know. This is the first issue of Young X-Men where I thought it showed some promise, but I don't know. I guess I'll probably give it about 10 issues, and then I'll decide if I'm going to keep buying it or not.
Okay. Let's talk about Uncanny X-Men.
All right.
So this is the first issue I've picked up since the move to San Francisco and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the story was really good. I like the idea of the mutants fighting discrimination,
right?
Because I think that's like the core of their story. And when you get back to the basics like that, you know, it's terrible what happened to Pixie and it's being dealt with. And I like her arc as far as, being kind of unsure of herself and kind of retreating into her own world and stuff like that and going home again and realizing that's not for her. I think that's done very well. And I like the characterization of Wolverine. I had some other problems though.
Okay.
One being, well, the first off, just, you know, we're not going to get into the the thing of Greg Land art in general, because we all know the controversy about that. But uh-huh. I will say that it has no place in this book.
You know, the thing is that other than the women that Greg Land draws, this book was great. Because when he's drawing action scenes, when he's drawing like Wolverine and Nightcrawler, they look great. But whenever you see Pixie or Dazzler or White Queen, it's just like, it's totally different from everything else in the book.
That's true. I even like Scott Summers. I like, you know, he looks good with the little, you know, grizzle on, yep. you know. I like that. I like a grizzled Scott Summers. That's my favorite type of Scott Summers.
I agree. His art is good. It's just like when he draws women, it's too much.
Like, I don't know the one that they brought in for the interrogation, but there's a scene of her walking out of the interrogation room and she's a big grin and she looks like she's posing for Sports Illustrated.
Yeah, the Black Queen or the Red Queen. We're not sure who it is yet.
And then Emma Frost, who... Now, I've only really read her in the Astonishing trade, but what I get from her is she's icy cold, she's kind of a bitch.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how everyone sees her, and that's how she acts. She's very distant emotionally from everyone. In this one, she like, never stops smiling. And, like, the whole thing, you know, she turns around, she flexes and shows off her body. I mean, it's a pinup. Again, it's a pinup. And this happened maybe two or three more times in this book, and it's just awful. It's the scene of Emma with Nightcrawler in the chapel, the very last bottom frame where she's just smiling. I mean, the heavy eyeshadow, I mean, she doesn't look good.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. I had some real problems with that. The scene back at the Hellfire Academy where they show Emma Frost teaching at the blackboard and she's like hardly wearing anything and got this big old grin on her face and stuff like that. I was like, oh my god.
It's just such a big like contrast to like what's going on in the story, and it's about Pixie and about, you know, like you said, discrimination, and then you have like this art that just like it totally contradicts the story.
Well, it's yeah, and it's just a little silly for me. And then when the red-haired dominatrix woman pulled off her mask, it's another Emma?
Yeah, I don't know who that is.
I've already seen this trick, though. This happened not that long ago.
Okay. Yeah, that's exactly what I was saying. I was like, what are we doing? This just happened in Astonishing, you know? That was a very good point. It kills me, because if you take out Emma, if you take out I'm not even sure if it's the Black Queen or the Red Queen. Take her out. This was a really good book. When you have Wolverine and Nightcrawler fighting the Hellfire Club gang, that was great. At the very end, where they're fighting Empath, who was a former Hellion, and like Empath is basically taking them out, and he shouldn't be able to do that because he's so much younger than they are. That was really good. But then throwing in like.
There were scenes that I liked. Like, I loved Cyclops and Wolverine and Nightcrawler at the end, like, going into those tunnels, and Beast is kind of back at the station, and it's like, there's no tunnels. It's like, well, we're going through one right now.
It was all very coordinated. Like, as soon as Wolverine went down, he talked to Scott, Scott talked to Kurt, Kurt talked to Hank, and I was just like, that's working.
Yeah, no, I love that. But it's just anytime a woman comes on page, their portrayal is very over-sexified.
Yeah, and I think the biggest issue I had with this issue was we haven't seen Dazzler in a while, like years, and there was a big rumor that she was going to come back to the team. And we see her, she shows up like a pinup, and she just shows up and says something to Pixie about Pixie coming along and seeing with her, and then that's it. That's all we see of Dazzler, and I'm just like, what?
No, is she like a pop star or something like that?
Yeah, Dazzler's like a musician pop star. She was with the X-Men late 80s, early 90s, maybe even 70s. But, if you're going to say Dazzler's going to come back, that's kind of a, you know, it's not a big deal. It's kind of a big deal if you're an X-Men fan, because you're like, oh, Dazzler's coming back.
Might want to be more than a cameo.
Yeah, I don't know if she's going to come back, and this is just the first time we saw her, or if that's it, if that's all we saw of her, then there was no reason for that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. This was all Fraction and Inland. The next story arc is going to be Brubaker, and then Dotson, and, you know, I'm going to enjoy Dotson's art a whole lot better. I mean, he draws some curvy women, but it's not in your face, and it's at least constant. I don't know. I think the thing about Land is, like, it's not even so much the fact that his women are over-sexified and all this stuff, but it's always, like, the fact that they're looking straight at you. That's, yeah. I think, the big thing.
They look like action figures. Like, they don't, when you see them, they're not, there's no fluidity in their movement, it feels like, to me, anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a very good point. They are always looking, like, right at you, and it's almost distracting. Mm-hmm. Last book I'm going to talk about is Hellblazer, number 247 with Andy Diggle. I've been reading this book since the Jason Aaron run, so I'm still pretty new to it, but I really like this book because the book lately has been dealing with religious issues and things like that, and John worked with this demon who he knew to get this certain book that he's looking for some kind of passage in it, and it's very long and convoluted, but in this one, they end up making this weird connection between the beginning of Christianity and how we celebrate it on December 25th, and it ties into this, what was it, like some saint, I can't remember what country he's from, but it ends up being Saint Nicholas, and like they uncover the bones of this Saint Nicholas, or otherwise known as Santa Claus, and it was just a really interesting tie-in. Like within the first three pages, I was immediately hooked on this, and what it ends up being is someone's trying to get eternal life and make a deal with the demon, and it's up to John to, you know, of course, root this out. And also this demon who's come to London to, he's basically gone through and killing all these mages, I guess, and John's on the list. And so there's going to be a confrontation happening, but this book is just so kind of off the wall and out there a little bit, but I love it. Like every strange little twist it makes, and it almost winks at you and says, I completely agree. We're being off the wall ridiculous.
Yeah.
But it's the perfect book to do that in. And so I really like Andy Diggle's writing. He did Green Arrow Year One, which I raved about when that came out. The artwork is really good. I'm trying to go through. Leonardo Menko is the artist. And the cover, I'm going to screw this up, Bermejo. But anyways, the art is fantastic, and with the writing, it's very dark, it's very sketchy, but I've been enjoying it. It's definitely caught my attention, and I'm reading it monthly now, so I'm enjoying it.
Cool. Yeah, it seems like a book that would be up your alley.
Mm-hmm.
All right, there's a couple of books I wanted to touch on from last week real quick. Ultimate Origins number 4 was what I picked last week as the best book of the week, and I kind of just wanted to mention it because I thought it was really, really, really good. Ultimate Origins is kind of getting caught up in the whole Ultimatum hype, which we don't know what Ultimatum's about. But this Ultimate Origins is kind of like, it's linking everything together in the Ultimate Universe. And when I first heard about that, I wasn't too hot on it. But then I heard that Bendis was doing it. And a lot of what Ultimate Origin is Nick Fury's origin story, which I love. I'm not... Ultimate Nick Fury is definitely in my top 5 characters ever.
And, really?
Yeah, and I'm surprised by that, but I love Ultimate Nick Fury. I've never really liked regular Nick Fury, but I'm a big, huge fan of Ultimate Nick Fury, and I think that actually made me a bigger fan of regular Nick Fury.
Okay.
But what we get in this issue here is a lot... We found out that... A while ago, we found out that Wolverine was a first mutant, and mutants weren't like an evolutionary, you know, they weren't involved.
They were created, right?
He was turned into a mutant. Nick Fury was captured, and he was given the super soldier serum, and he's basically the only one that survived. So he's just like in the regular Marvel universe, he's like a pseudo Captain America. He finally starts taking up S.H.I.E.L.D., and he tasks Hank Pym, Bruce Banner, and Richard Parker, Peter Parker's father, to work on the serum. So this is where this is all starting to come together. Yeah. And Hank kind of like eggs Bruce into taking the serum when he's obviously not supposed to. That's how he becomes the Hulk. And the whole time Richard is there and he's against all this stuff. You find out that Richard had a son, and Richard, Mary, Peter's mother, and Peter, they come as a, Peter's a baby, come to visit. That's the same point where Bruce takes a serum for the whole time, and he kills them. So you find out that that's how ultimate Peter Parker's parents died.
By the Hulk?
It was the first time that Bruce Banner turned into the Hulk.
Mm.
Which I thought was really cool. Like, I was so excited about that, because that we haven't even... Bendis hasn't even mentioned, like, how they died. You just kind of know that they died. And in the regular Marvel Universe, they died in a plane crash, and they were secret agents and all that stuff. And I thought that was really good. What's up?
Oh, see, when I read the original Ultimates, I got the impression that the Hulk hadn't been around that long.
The Hulk had been around for a while, yeah. He had just been contained. It was something that Bruce had just was dealing with. Because they talked about that there's other Hulk incidents, but they never alluded to what they were.
Okay.
And then what was really cool is at the very end of this, you see that Mary and Richard are dead. Peter somehow survived. And Nick Fury shows up. He kind of takes Banner down. And he takes Peter, and he's like, you know, you're going to have a rough life. Which really kind of goes into Ultimate Spider-Man and the relationship that Nick Fury and Peter Parker has, because Nick Fury's always there for Peter Parker. And it's always kind of weird, because he can always do stuff to him, he can always kind of arrest him, but he always helps him. And this issue really gave, like, new light to why that is. And then the very last thing is that throughout the four issues so far, there have been these little totem poles showing up all over the place. And that's been kind of the big mystery, is that all of a sudden these totem poles open up and it looks like they have a camera and you don't know what they are. Reed is trying to figure it out. You think they're bombs or whatever. And at the very end, one kind of takes over Sue's mind, and Sue's like, it watches. And that's all she says. And so it's the ultimate form of the Watcher, which I was like, that's really cool. Like, I love the way that they did that. So I was just, like, giddy all over the place with that issue. I thought it was just great. I feel like it's getting really swept up in Ultimatum. It's just like, this isn't a story of its own. It's just the prequel to Ultimatum, which is too bad, because I have a feeling that Ultimatum's going to suck. But this was really good. So.
Okay. Let's also recap a little bit of Secret Invasion last week.
Secret Invasion number 6. What did you think?
I thought it was okay. I wasn't blown away by it. Like, I thought it was, you know, it was cool. I liked Thor showing up at the end and the whole talk, you know, my God has a hammer.
Yeah.
And, you know, Thor showing up, which was cool. The thing is, like, I'm just not a huge Thor fan, and I'm also, like, I like Bucky showing up, or Captain America, I guess now, but... I'm not a huge Thor fan, and Tony Stark in the comics anyway is kind of tainted for me, because he's been through so much a little bit, he's a little tarnished. Uh-huh. And then you have like characters like the Hood, who, as we've seen in New Avengers, he's a bad guy, and he's a colossal bad guy.
Right.
And yet he's fighting alongside the heroes at the end. So those two like last big pages of, you know, one against the other, I don't know, I just didn't feel like, I felt like I should have been, like, throwing my fist up in the air and being like, yeah, but I just wasn't. Like, I just needed a little bit more out of it, and I didn't get that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the problem is the setup. I think it makes sense that the Hood is going to join them, because they even kind of talk about it, you know, all the villains are like, well, we're not going to help the heroes. And the Hood's like, well, we don't have a planet. There's nothing to take over. And that makes sense. But that's the only scene that we saw. You know, we need to see more going into that. I've become a huge fan of Thor. And I really like Thor showing up. But more importantly, I like the way he showed up. Because he's just raining down lightning in one place. And he's doing that to gather up heroes. And I thought that was really cool, something he would do.
Yeah.
Two issues I kind of have with the story is that other than Tony Stark, no one knows who that Bucky is Cap. as far as I know.
That's a good point.
So that's not something that people are going to take lightly. Like, if you see someone else in a Captain America uniform, brand new, holding a shield...
Yeah, you'd be like, what the hell?
Even if it's a Skrull threat, I mean, going on, everyone's going to be like, what the crap? I mean...
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering if Tony might have told some people, because... Hawkeye, he knows.
Hawkeye knew, yeah. I mean, I think the only people who know are Hawkeye,
But it's not like Hawkeye and Tony talk to each other, because they're on separate teams, so...
Right, Hawkeye, Tony Stark, Black Widow knows, and then, Falcon. I think those are the only people who really know. So I thought that was a little bit iffy. Another thing that I feel like I've been having a problem kind of with the story, and I think one of the things that I realized with these double-page spreads is that I'm not a huge fan of the different Skrulls who have different powers. Normally, it kind of be cool, but I think it feels like it's almost gotten gimmicky, because the very end of this issue, in the giant spread, you actually see a Galactus Skrull.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're kind of... You actually mentioned this a couple weeks ago, when the Skrulls kind of... They go from these savages to an actual threat to these religious zealots, you know? And I feel like seeing a Galactus-type Skrull, it's like, that's ridiculous, you know? And that's going to kind of take me out of the story, because like, that's not even a threat. That's just like way over the top, and that's gimmicky, and that's, I mean, come on.
Yeah, it's like, how many different ways, you know, how many different characters can we draw as Skrulls? And yeah, I totally agree with that. It's cheesy at that point.
Yeah, I mean, because like, the Skrulls should be like an army, there should be an actual threat, but like... It seems like it's important to them to be like, this is the X-Men Skrull, and we have a Dr. Octopus Skrull and a Green Goblin Skrull. So it's like, I don't need to see that, you know? Just like, I just want to read the story. So...
Yeah, at this point, like, I'm just not threatened by the Skrulls anymore. Like, even like halfway through the Sinestro Corps War, or even at the end, or even still in Green Lantern Corps book, when I see a Sinestro Corps member... And I remember thinking this when we first saw like the Sinestro Corps Guardian and the army that they were amassing. I was like, holy shit. And I feel like I should feel the same about the Skrulls.
You're exactly right. I think there's two issues left. Ben has talked a lot. I listened to him on Word Balloon. He said like, you know, the end of issue 6 is what people have been waiting for. And he kind of came on afterwards and he's like, you know, this is the whole idea behind Secret Invasion. This is the Marvel Universe come together for the first time in, you know, like 10 years, which is true. You know, since the Civil War and stuff before that, this is finally all the heroes together, which is cool.
Yeah.
But something big needs to happen in the story. And we haven't had any major reveals. I mean, the stuff with Spider-Woman and Hank Pym, they weren't even revealed in Secret Invasion. They were revealed in the Avengers books. So something big has to happen. It looks like there's something that might happen with the Wasp. Hank Pym gave her a serum in Mighty Avengers, and that might play into this. But something big like has to happen. Like, we have to find out that someone's been a Skrull, someone has to die, or else this is just going to seem kind of empty.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree.
So, we'll see. We've got a couple issues left.
Yeah. Well, I think that does it for the books we want to talk about this week. Next week, we're going to be coming back with some more reviews. We're going to be talking about the Force Unleashed video game, which both David and I are playing right now.
Yep.
And liking very much. And then also, Heroes Season 3 Villains is going to be on soon. And so, we will definitely be giving you our thoughts on that.
Yep.
And so... you can always, if you have questions for us or you want to talk to us about any of those issues, you can email us at contact@fanboystrikeback.com. You can also go to our website, which is www.fanboystrikeback.blogspot.com. And that is where we post our written review of the week, along with other articles that we think are interesting. And we also have a link to our forums page on there, which we go on, we post topics, video game topics, TV topics, things of that nature, comics, and talk about stuff we don't get to talk about on the show. We always love to see you on there. And we are found on most podcatchers.
Yep, iTunes, Podcast Alley, really any podcatcher out there. If you like the show, leave us a review. That kind of helps us out, lets more people hear the show. And if you know someone who would like the show, please tell them about it. Word of mouth, it's always going to help us out. Like Eric said, shoot us an email, come by the forum. We're going to be talking in depth about The Forest Unleashed, but we already have a little thread up there talking about what we think about it so far. Heroes is going to be coming on soon. I've been playing a little Rock Band 2 this week, so we'll probably start some stuff about that too. So, yeah, I'm kind of busy with actually fun stuff for once.
Nice. All right, well, that does it for us this week, so we'll be back next week.